You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Happy Monday. Okay, first introduced on this radio program. Well, actually, it was, Rob Call's been writing about this for about a year over at opednews.com, and I'm sure that there have been people long before that, but the first time I talked about it was on this radio show a couple of weeks ago. We called it the No Billionaires Campaign. In fact, we created a hashtag No Billionaires Campaign. And they just received, just received, because there is no official, it's evolving. You are now part of it, if you wish. Just received our biggest boost yet, harsh criticism from Fox so-called News, the network owned by billionaire Rupert Murdoch. Last week, Murdoch employee Greta Van Susteren and the Weekly Standard's Stephen Hayes, a magazine that got its start thanks to a generous grant from billionaire Rupert Murdoch, feigned outrage over the campaign, devoting 6 minutes of television to trashing the idea. First, here's what I had to say about this on my radio show last week that they played. Yes? No? Maybe? We don't have that. Okay. Well, basically what I had to say on my radio show last week was, billionaires in 100 lifetimes, they can't spend all that money. I mean, I have no problem with somebody getting their first million or even 100 million or even 200 million or 500 million or 900 million or 999 million. But after $1 billion, I'm suggesting we should have a wealth tax in the United States that kicks in at the level of 100%. This is for personal wealth, not necessarily wealth that's held in a corporate form. So there's some distinctions here, and there would still be a lot of people who could control more than $1 billion. But I'm talking about just, what you have in your checking account and your own personal assets. So here's what Greta and Steve Hayes responded with.
I usually try to be respectful of people who have different views, but there's no way to be respectful of that. I mean, it is a completely idiotic argument that has no basis in economic theory. It doesn't make any sense on its face of it. We have 425 billionaires in the United States with an average net worth of about $4 billion each. If you confiscated all of their wealth, all of it in its entirety, it would basically take care of the U.S. deficit for 1 year. I mean, it doesn't do nothing to solve our long-term fiscal problem.
Yeah, now these guys are hysterical about the U.S. deficit, which is, I mean, we don't have a deficit problem. But in any case, to begin with, the No Billionaires campaign isn't about reducing the deficit. In fact, we don't have a debt crisis in America. We have a demand crisis, which is why we also have an unemployment crisis. Average working people don't have enough money to spend, so goods and services aren't in demand, so people can't afford to buy them, and therefore businesses aren't hiring new employees to make things because nobody can afford to buy them. The No Billionaire campaign addresses this demand crisis head on instead of trying to go after the phony debt crisis. The campaign meant to distribute wealth from those at the very top who can't possibly spend all the billions they're hoarding to working people whose new disposable income, when spent, will power the economy and generate wealth for everyone. As billionaire Nick Hanauer has repeatedly said, there can never be enough super-rich Americans to power a great economy. Simply not possible. Though billionaires have millions of times more wealth than average Americans, they do not buy millions more in groceries or shoes or cars. Simply put, the 400 richest American billionaires just don't have the purchasing power of hundreds of millions of working-class Americans with a solid middle-class income. That's why it's a lie to call billionaires job creators. Working people spending money is what creates jobs, not rich people, whether their billions are sitting in Cayman Island bank accounts or in the stock of Microsoft. But Hayes and Van Susteren then dismissed the case as not serious and radio shtick.
I couldn't tell if he was like really serious or just sort of,
maybe it was like radio shtick.
Shtick or something. Like I thought, like, and I don't know how we tell, but I sort of thought like, he's just saying stuff.
Yeah, well, I'd say that's wishful thinking on their part. I mean, imagine if the American people did finally wake up and recognize billionaires for what they really are. Many of them, parasites on our economic body. But it is a serious campaign, and it's a campaign that was seriously pondered by our founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson explicitly suggested that if individuals became so rich that their wealth could influence or challenge government, then their wealth should be decreased upon their death. In other words, an inheritance tax, a Paris Hilton tax. In a letter to Joseph Milligan on April 6, 1816, he wrote, quote, "If the overgrown wealth of an individual be deemed dangerous to the state, the best corrective is the law of equal inheritance to all in equal degree," end quote. In other words, you know, take their money and distribute it to everybody. And the dangerous to the state, I mean, think about what some of these billionaires, well, the Koch brothers who inherited money from their daddy Fred, and they've made a, you know, a fair amount of their own on, along the way, but influencing our legislation, public policy, that seems to me dangerous to the state. Also in 1816, Jefferson wrote a letter to Samuel Kercheval, explicitly laying out the dangers of an entrenched aristocracy as today's billionaire class has now become. Jefferson wrote, "Those seeking profits, were they given total freedom, would not be the ones to trust to keep government pure and our rights secure. Indeed, it has always been those seeking wealth who were the source of corruption in government. No other depositories of power have ever yet been found which did not end in converting to their own profit the earnings of those committed to their charge," end quote. And no, Greta, that was not Thomas Jefferson's radio shtick. Nor was it Ben Franklin's radio shtick in 1783 when he wrote about how we the people have a right, an obligation, to confiscate excess wealth and property from others, since most of that wealth was created by we the people in the first place. As Franklin writes in a letter to Robert Morris, "All property seems to me to be the creature of public convention." He continues, "All the property that is necessary to a man for the conservation of the individual and the propagation of the species is his natural right, which none can justly deprive him of. But all property superfluous to such purposes is the property of the public, who by their laws have created it, and who may therefore by other laws dispose of it whenever the welfare of the public shall demand such disposition." End quote, Ben Franklin. Franklin then turns his attention to those like Van Susteren and Hayes, who work for billionaires and thus are outraged by this idea. He writes, quote, "He that does not like civil society on these terms, let him retire and live among savages. He can have no right to the benefits of society who will not pay his club toward the support of it," end quote. So in this emerging battle over the No Billionaires campaign, the employees of billionaire Rupert Murdoch have staked out their position, and it's on the opposite end of the most celebrated founding fathers. But the two billionaire lackeys went on.
"It's not like they're sitting around eating chocolates and watching TV and doing nothing and just counting their money. A lot of these billionaires are taking their billions and doing, you know, really fine things around the world,
yeah,
and even here in the United States.
Whether they're doing it for charity or whether they're reinvesting in their own companies and developing new technologies, employing more people, I mean, all of that, I think, is doing some good."
Actually, no. As economist David K. Johnston recently uncovered, the billionaires of corporate America have made a calculated decision to not reinvest their money in new technology or new workers. Currently, American companies are sitting on more than $5 trillion in cash, hoarding it like mentally ill people hoard newspapers or cats. And when they do decide to spend it, more often than not, they're spending it overseas to hire foreign workers and open foreign factories. The Wall Street Journal reported that over the last decade, America's biggest corporations, headed up by America's wealthiest billionaires, have fired nearly 3 million Americans from their workforce while hiring more than 2 million new workers overseas. So I'm going to get back to this, finish up this rant on the other side of this break. And you know, plus, there's a whole pile of stuff in the news. And the hostage taking is afoot. Time for the trillion-dollar coin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, the trillion-dollar coin. You heard me right. We've been talking about that for, 2 years now, I think, ever since Ellen Brown first mentioned it on this program. Great idea. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. What exactly are Van Susteren's? Greta Van Susteren went off on me last week with Stephen Hayes. And so what exactly are their response on Fox so-called news? What exactly are their responses to those billionaires who are choosing to fire their workers or at least reduce their hours instead of comply with the new Obamacare mandate to provide health insurance for these same workers? And what are the responses to the enormous gulf that's developed between worker productivity and workers' wages in America? As a direct result of the billionaires' greed, corporate America has pocketed virtually all the increased profits from their workers, that's you and me, increased productivity. The typical hourly wage for an American worker increased just $1.23 over the last 36 years after accounting for inflation. Meanwhile, the top 1% has seen their incomes increase since 275% since Reagan's election. Today, workers' wages as a percentage of GDP are at an all-time low, yet corporate profits as a percentage of GDP are at an all-time high. So this idea that our economy rests on the shoulders of benevolent billionaires is a total fabrication. To the shock of Ayn Rand and the employees of billionaire Rupert Murdoch, if billionaires one day finally shrugged and left town, as in Atlas Shrugged, nothing would happen. Finally, Hayes tried to justify the enormous wealth inequality between billionaires and working Americans by saying this.
One of the great things about the country, going back historically, is the fact that people who find themselves in the lowest income quintiles are more likely to be in an upper income quintile 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, than they are to be still in the lower income quintile. But we don't hear those stories told nearly as much.
In reality, the rise of the billionaires and the wealth inequality they've wrought has destroyed this once what he called a great thing about this country. It's called economic and social mobility. The New York Times reported, quote, at least five large studies in recent years have found the United States to be less mobile than comparable nations, end quote. Pew Research Center found that two-thirds of Americans born in the top quintile, the top fifth of Americans, stay in at least the top two quintiles. Also, more than two-thirds of Americans born in the bottom quintile, the poorest fifth, stay in at least the bottom two quintiles. And as researchers Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson have proven, with their groundbreaking work at the Equality Trust in the United Kingdom, there are direct correlations between high wealth inequality and low social mobility, which the United States now has thanks to the billionaires who fatten their own wallets at the expense of their workers, their community, and their nation. So it's really no big surprise that commentators at Fox so-called News are outraged by our No Billionaires campaign. After all, their paychecks, like everyone else's at Fox News, depend on towing the line for their billionaire boss and his billionaire buddies. But it is interesting that corporate America's favorite news network hates the idea so much. It means we must be on the right track. You can join us at hashtag NoBillionairesCampaign on Twitter. And we'll have the website up in a day or two here at NoBillionaires.com. So check it out. It should be fun. Carol in Charleston, New Hampshire. Hey, Carol, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I got firsthand knowledge that Reaganomics is ruining this country. My husband used to work for a company that was in the town for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And before, when the capital gains was high, they used to pass it down to their family. And in 2004, they could keep all the money. They just sold out the company. And then the ones who bought the company shipped all the jobs to China. So all these people that say, we're reaping Reaganomics crap now. We're really reaping it. And we can't get out of it because people are so deluded into lies from the Republicans. They believe it.
Yep. I absolutely agree. We are seeing the cancer stage of capitalism. We are seeing the end stage of Reaganomics. And you are totally right. Totally right. Mark Taylor Canfield, writing and blogging about the Occupy Wall Street movement in Seattle. Hey, Mark, this is very much right down the alley of Occupy Wall Street.
Yes, it is, because it started out as a movement for the 99%, which, if you look around the country, it's pretty much continued that way in terms of the Occupy Sandy movement, taking on volunteering in the community when the government and, you know, electrical companies and utilities don't come through. The home foreclosure is trying to buy up debt, and there in New York, all of this stuff is a sort of an attempt to fight back. And I'm proud to say that I'm in a state that is fighting back, and I'm looking forward to a future in Washington State where not only do we have same-sex marriage and legalization of marijuana, but we just qualified an initiative for the ballot. This is a breaking story. To label genetically modified organisms, to label genetically modified
cool.
food and seeds. In fact, San Juan County here in Washington State, Tom, already voted to ban all genetically modified organisms. They're totally banned from being grown in San Juan County here in Washington State already.
Yeah.
And there are 61 other countries, you know, who have already, you know, passed laws requiring labeling. So I would just say, you know, if we can get free education and no genetically modified organisms in this state and a state publicly owned bank, I think we will really show Wall Street what can be done outside of this whole 1%
control. Oh, if Washington State had a publicly, you know, the mechanism that the 1% are really the 0.001%, but nonetheless, the mechanism that the billionaires are using to really put the screws, not just to middle class people and working people, but to nations, is banks, is banking. It's the interest-based banking system. And if states were to open their own banks, as North Dakota has had since 1909, I think, when states open their own banks, then all that business that the state does, all the pension funds, all that money that is right now with Chase and Citibank and whatnot, if that's with the state bank, then the profit that comes from interest goes back into the state treasury, which is one of the reasons why North Dakota has always had a balanced budget and great employment. So, yeah, the state bank movement is a big one, too. Mark Taylor Canfield, thanks a lot for the call, Mark. Great to hear from you. 27 minutes past the hour. Hashtag No Billionaires Campaign. Check it out. Or I suppose hashtag No Billionaires would be the same. We're going to have to figure out which one of these. Yeah, it is shorter, so that's better. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back here on the Tom Hartman Program. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. We are, by the way, if you have listened to NPR recently, you've probably heard in one of many segments, Cato Institute or the Heritage Foundation or the other various right-wing think tanks funded by the Koch brothers, who pretty much pop up on NPR every single day talking about the Canadian miracle, how the Canadians cut spending back in the 90s and it helped their economy. First of all, it's a lie, just for the record, just so you know. I mean, this is a great example of the old saying, liars can figure, but figures don't lie. To say that just like that is a lie. There was a spending cut, but there was also a tax increase. There was a spending freeze. There were spending increases. Spending actually went up during the period of the greatest Canadian expansion, as did taxes. And Canada basically grew their way out of their problems. They didn't cut their way out of their problems. But nonetheless, what you will hear from the Koch-funded organizations, Cato, Heritage, whatever, you know, all of them, these various Hoover Institution, these others. I don't know if Hoover is funded by the Kochs or not, but is that, we need to do what the Canadians did and cut our way. Not so much. In our third hour, we're going to have an actual Canadian economist on who is going to fill us in all the details. In our second hour, Jamie Weinstein is going to come on with a Daily Caller, senior editor of the Daily Caller. We're going to talk about the platinum coin to fix the debt ceiling. And just the whole debt ceiling debate and issue. But right now, I am saying, here's my point. We don't have a debt crisis in the United States. We may at some point in the future, if inflation, you know, goes up above 4 or 5%, it may start getting very expensive for us to have the debt that we have right now. But even the debt that we have right now, we can easily get out of by simply growing our economy. If the Republicans who are so wed to this austerity agenda of cutting government, if they were to simply stop that and say, no, we're going to do what the Republicans did in 1952, what Dwight Eisenhower did, and we're going to spend our way out of this by putting people to work, then you'd have millions of Americans who would go from being net takers of money from the government in the form of food stamps, welfare benefits, and unemployment benefits to net givers to the government of tax money. Tax revenues would explode, government expenditures would go down, and the deficit would vanish, just like it did after World War II. simply by putting people to work. Eisenhower put people to work building the national highway system. So it's pretty straightforward stuff. Bill in Homewood, Illinois. Hey, Bill, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Happy New Year.
And the same to you, Bill.
My blood got boiling a little bit when I heard the dulcet tones of Greta Van Susteren calling your commentary radio shtick.
Yeah.
Because I was reminded of this, if you even want to call it journalism, this fluff softball interview she did with Scott Walker at the height of the
Well, let me just defend Greta, if I may. I have done softball interviews with, you know, any number of Democratic politicians. I'll get them on to talk about an issue that I agree with them on. There are other issues that I disagree with them on that I'm not bringing up, and I'm not kicking them around because I'm trying to stay focused on one particular issue. It's just that's kind of the nature of the media. You could pick on her for, you know, whatever you want, but that's probably not the strongest thing to do so. And besides that, okay, she's not here to defend herself, so let's not kick around Greta, all right?
Okay. Okay. Well, can I just maybe point out, to me, it's a connect the dots, though, type of thing. If you see what the Wisconsin legislature is, the Republican-led, is going to start to do with mining, fracking in that state, connect the dots, I guess, is all I was kind of getting at. But no, I agree with you. Greta cannot defend herself. So
yeah. But, you know, the big thing, apropos of what you're saying, is, and very few people know about this, is that there is this kind of silent underground campaign that is being put together to get 34 states to introduce on the 4th of July of this year an Article 5 request for constitutional convention to make one amendment to the Constitution, which would require a two-thirds majority in both the House and Senate to raise taxes on billionaires and millionaires. No supermajority necessary to raise taxes on working people via sales taxes. That's just fine. But if you're going to raise income taxes, you have to have a two-thirds supermajority. And this is the thing that Scott Walker and Rick Scott and Rick Snyder and Haley, not Haley Barber, I don't think he's in office anymore. Yeah, Rick Snyder. I mean, you know, the list goes on. Nikki Haley in South Carolina and Bobby Jindal and Chris Christie. All these Republican governors. This is what they're planning in the background on July 4th. And you probably haven't heard a word about this because it's gotten virtually no press coverage. But on July 4th, they are going to roll out an attempt to actually amend the Constitution. And there's actually a reasonable possibility that they will be able to pull it off. And there is no campaign that can stop it. There's no public action that can stop it. There's no election that can stop it. So it's going to be very, very interesting to watch. You need to keep your eye out for that. Bill, thanks for the call. Jay in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hey, Jay, you think I'm just doing radio stick, huh? Or shtick.
Well, I do think that when you say $1 billion, if you can, that's so unrealistic. If you said something more like a million or 2 million, I would say that I agree. But people have no business having $674 million. That's.
So you think I'm being too liberal here, too generous?
Oh God, yes. You don't need a $500 million. If you don't need a billion, you don't need a $500 million.
Okay, you know, I'm going to stay at a billion. Because we're talking a wealth tax here. We're talking, you know, this is not income, it's wealth, although there are guys on Wall Street who literally make $1 billion or $2 billion every single year. So, you know, they would hit that wealth tax really fast. But I think, and I also think that there's something about the optics of it, of simply saying, you know, millionaires, we will endure, billionaires, no. And the reason why, Jay, that I'm concerned about this, and thanks for the call, the reason why I'm concerned about this is that, you know, you've got a couple $100 million. At that point, your lifestyle gets real expensive. Typically, I mean, this is what, I'm not speaking from experience here, but I have, you know, I do know some of these folks. I have seen their lifestyles. They get the private jet, they get the extra house in Switzerland, they get, you know, and pretty soon life is expensive and they want to leave something for their families and they want to have dynasties and all that. So they're less inclined to throw $150 million into a political campaign the way that Shelley Adelson did. Shelley Adelson's worth over $10 billion. So $100 million to him is nothing. It's chump change. And so using as my metric Jefferson's warning that extreme wealth can damage democracy. I realize somebody worth $900 million or even $500 million, you know, they could throw enough money into a political campaign to really badly distort it. But, you know, if we could start at a billion and probably end there, one of the other points that Greta Van Susteren made on the show, or maybe it was Steve Hayes, was, oh, yeah, they're going to put this $1 billion tax in, and then next year they'll say, oh, $1 billion? Anybody can live on $1 billion. How about $500 million? Anybody can live on $500 million. Then the year after that they'll make it, how about $100 million? Anybody can live on $100 million. And then the year after that it's $10 million. Who needs more than $10 million? Then the year after that it's $1 million. Who needs more than $1 million? And then the year after that it's $100,000. Hey, can't you live on $100,000? And pretty soon you got the Soviet state. No, I'm not suggesting we go in that direction. And frankly, I don't think we would. I think Americans like the idea of people being able to become obscenely rich. The question is, where does obscenely rich begin? And I would say obscenely rich probably starts at tens of millions of dollars into the hundreds of millions of dollars. But anything over $1 billion is stupidly rich. In terms of democracy, not at the individual level. As I said, there are some very, very smart billionaires, multi-billionaires, who, you know, by the rules of the game, made their money. I honor that, and I'm saying anything over $1 billion, I think, is destructive to democracy, to paraphrase Jefferson, and there should be a tax at that point. Frank in Bensalem, Pennsylvania, am I saying that right?
How you doing?
Hey, Frank.
I was calling about the Canada situation you were discussing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a union rep, and I go into Canada quite often. I always have debates with the union reps up there about, you know, organizing and the difference between the National Labor Relations Board and their format.
Right.
Up in Canada, wages are so much higher for general labor and general everything compared to the people.
Well, that's because they got about 30% unionization in Canada, and that sets the floor for everybody else.
Well, it's a lot easier to organize in Canada, too, and,
yep.
And you have a lot stronger laws. For example, I had one organizer tell me up there, I was frank, he says, you know, you think we have it so good? He says, sometimes it takes us 6 months to achieve a contract if an employer is going to drag it out. I said, I have one that's going on 8 years,
yeah.
And I'm no further along. Yeah. The workers here today are like sheep. I mean, it's really pathetic.
Well, they're terrified.
People will not unite.
They're terrified.
People, I mean, my kids came back from New York this week, and they watched this play called The Newsies, which is, I'm sure you heard.
I haven't.
Those kids, and it's a true story, those kids back in the 1800s had more, I don't know, a better
oh,
word.
Oh, you're talking about Les Mis?
Yeah, the people.
Yeah, Les Mis. Louise and I saw Les Mis over the weekend. We've seen the stage play before, but the movie is breathtaking. If you have not, and thank you, Frank, if you have not seen Les Mis, you know, get out there and watch it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The two really cultural and economic and social and political movies of the moment and of the year, I think, are Les Mis and Django Unchained. And welcome back to your media support group for We the People, a Tom Hartman program. Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, you want to talk about billionaires?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for your show and all the work that you do. The acquisition of wealth in the form of money in this country seems to be the driving force
mm-hmm.
behind the meaning of success.
Mm-hmm.
And when most rational people, I think, come to realize eventually that money, while important, is not the end of all means. And in the case of the billionaires, I think it's either got to be a huge ego trip or some sort of mental disorder, you know, similar to hoarding.
Well, I think it depends on the person.
I think that if they finally reach that goal or that magic number, so to speak, you know, they really shouldn't have a problem with just giving some of it back, you know, for the good of the rest of society.
Yeah.
And that's who they took it from in the first place.
Well,
that may be kind of idealistic, but what do you think?
Well, I, and thank you for your call, Dave, and thanks for the point. in some cases, with some people, I don't disagree. I think that there, on the other hand, are some people who, you know, played by the rules, played the game hard, but played the game reasonably and made wild amounts of money. And the question we have to ask ourselves as a society is that a good thing for democracy? I don't have a problem with people being very, very rich. I don't. I do have a problem with America being the richest country in the world and having a bunch of people who are very, very poor. That's wrong. And so, you know, a modest level of redistribution of income like Ben Franklin talked about or Thomas Jefferson talked about is something that I would absolutely agree with. And I don't think that all billionaires, you know, are suffering from hoarding syndrome. I think that some are. But I know one person who's probably worth just a million or a little more, who never really hit it big, never really had a large successful business, but has basically been a money hoarder his entire life. Every penny is like, you know, precious. And, you know, you could argue it's worked out well for him because he's got a fair amount of money now in his old age, whereas, you know, most people just kind of spend it through their lives. But in any case, Dustin in Maryland Heights, Missouri. Hey, Dustin, you wanted to talk about billionaires.
Yeah, Tom, you know, I believe his name's George Lakoff. Is that the man?
Yeah, I know George.
You've been having him on the show. He talks about framing issues. And
yeah, he's been on our program a number of times.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we talk about debt when they frame the issue as debt. You know, like you always say, you know, it's not so much a debt crisis as a revenue crisis.
Well, it's a jobs crisis, really, because if you put more people to work, they'll pay more taxes, which will pay down the debt. It's a real simple equation.
Absolutely. And tax revenues as a percentage of GDP as low as it's been since the Eisenhower administration.
Yep.
You know, you can decrease the deficit by you can increase taxes, you can cut spending, or you can grow the economy. I think when you let the frame be dominated by looking at it as debt, it conjures up this image that something's piling on and we have to take away from it. While you look at it through the frame of a revenue crisis, it looks at something that is deficient that we need to add. More progressive taxation, more demand in our economy.
Yeah, and more jobs.
Pretty interesting way to look at it.
And more jobs. Absolutely. Very well said, Dustin. Dustin, thank you very much for the call. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Before I get to my main point comparing the economy to the circulatory system, I'd just like to say, you know, last week when that woman came back at you strangely saying you were just jealous of the billionaires, I think a good point to counter that is what you do with your copyright. You give it away after a while.
Yeah.
You're not a person who's shown signs of trying to hoard it. I mean, it was weird. You just had nothing else to come back.
Yeah, two of my books, actually, which are still in print, and so meaning people can buy them in bookstores and I get a small, you know, people don't realize how little authors get, you know, on a $10 book, an author might end up with 10 or 20 cents. But still, they're in the bookstores and people can buy them and I'll make money off that. Two of those books are available on truthout.org for free. You can download them. You can read them on your anything, you know.
Yeah, and your actions are contradictory to what she was saying.
Yeah.
Anyway, one thing that's neglected in looking at the economy is I think we need to look at like a circulatory system. Flow is one of the most important things. As Paul Krugman just said, you know, my spending is your income and your spending is my income.
Mm-hmm.
And so like when someone gets paid, say, a dollar, and it's minimum wage and they spend it every 2 weeks, it goes through the system 26 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
This essentially becomes like 26 bucks, whereas someone who hoards their money, and even if they're investing in, they get, say, a 20% return per year. That basically is a coagulation of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we should really be looking at these, you know, what they call job creators, more as cash stashers.
Yeah.
Kind of like cholesterol on the system. They slow it down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are embolisms or
blood clots.
Yeah.
Cash.
Yeah. Or what is it where things back up and form, where they get bigger and bigger and bigger, they swell up.
Hemorrhages?
No, cysts. Hemorrhages are just bleeding. Cysts,
yeah,
you know, people get cysts on their organs. The most common, I suppose, is ovarian cysts, where they just fill up with fluid, sometimes with blood. But
in every system, anyway, flow is one of the most important aspects. I mean, everything you look at in life.
Yeah.
And, you know, having billionaires hoarding cash stashers, does not make a system work.
It's excellent.
Much more important. You know, we need upsurge economics or rising tide stuff.
Excellent.
We pay the people the bottom, and it flows.
Excellent meme, Jeff. Thank you for sharing it, and thanks for calling. Reginald in Houston, Texas. Hey, Reginald, we have a minute to the end of the hour. It's yours.
Hey, look here, Tom. Hey, man, look here. I got some good news for you out of New York Times here. Housing crisis will be $10 billion deal looms on foreclosures. $10 billion settlement to resolve claims on foreclosure abuse by major lenders is expected to be announced on Monday after weeks of negotiation between federal regulators and 14 banks. Several people with knowledge of the discussion of the settlement follows a sweeping deal in February between the state attorney generals and five large mortgage lenders.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with this, Reginald. Here's my concern. The $40 billion is nice, or $10 billion, or whatever it ends up being, but it looks like this was a $4 trillion theft. And these banks are getting immunity from all of their robo-signing crimes, so nobody's going to go to jail, which means in the future it's going to be viewed as a cost of doing business. The banks are not paying back all the money they stole. They're paying back a fraction of the money they stole, and nobody's going to jail. I think it's great that at least something got done. But my understanding is that in working this deal out, the administration felt constrained by the fear that if they really held the banks accountable for the real damage they did, it would take the banks down. And it may well do that. And to that, I would say, great, take the banks down. There are plenty of small banks that will step in to fill that space. Reginald, thank you very much for the call. We will be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Jamie Weinstein is on the line with us. He is the senior editor at the Daily Caller, dailycaller.com. Of course, the website, co-author of the new book, The Lizard King. Jamie, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And your website, Jamie_Weinstein. Oh, Twitter and at Daily Caller as well. So on this debt ceiling thing, here's what I don't understand. Why is it that Republicans in Congress would vote for a tax cut that, you know, the Bush tax cuts that added a trillion or so to our debt, would vote for two different wars that each added a trillion or so to our debt, would vote to ban Medicare from negotiating pharmaceutical prices, which is adding $600 billion to our debt, and would vote, you know, with appropriations bills. They would vote for all of these expenditures. In other words, they put all this money on the credit card, on the governmental credit card, as it were. But then when the bill comes due and has to be paid, because Congress doesn't have a checkbook, they don't have the ability to write checks. Only the Treasury Department can write checks, and they work for the White House. They work as part of the executive branch. When the bill comes due and has to be paid, Congress says, oh, no, you can't pay the bill. I don't get it.
I'll answer that question, Tom, but just a correction. You called them the Bush tax cuts. I think at this point, they're the consensus tax cuts. The President Obama just supported.
Well, let me reframe that. Reagan tax cuts, because we've been running massive deficits with the exception of 1 year, and even that's arguable, since the Reagan tax cuts. That's when it really exploded. So here we have 32 years of continuous tax cuts that have all been voted for by Republicans. And now that it's time to pay for them.
Democrats.
And Democrats, too. But you know, the tax cuts are driven by and large by the Republicans. And now that it's time to pay for them, the Democrats are perfectly willing to pay for them. The Republicans don't want to pay for the bills that they have already committed to.
Yeah.
How do you possibly justify this in any kind of Barry Goldwater conservative sense?
Well, the truth is that this whole tax thing is you know, just a nonsense issue. You know, where the money lies is in entitlement spending. I'm not talking about paying the debts that we ran up.
You can't not
talk about that when we're talking about the debt ceiling coming up.
Why not?
I agree with you generally that the debt ceiling is not the ideal forum to kind of force this issue to the table. But it seems like no other forum is working to get it to the president's mind.
Well, there's a very simple one, Jamie.
In the Democrats' mind to actually deal with our looming entitlement crisis. They keep seeming
to want to deal with entitlements, Jamie. There, you know, if first of all, Social Security is just fine, thank you very much. And it's got $2.7 trillion sitting in a savings account.
This is fantasy land.
It's solvent for at least 20 years.
You know that a savings account is not in actual cash. They're in U.S. bonds.
Yeah, the same kind of treasury bonds that George Bush was born with when he was born with $1 million in his trust fund. You think that he didn't actually have that wealth?
I think that if you don't fix the entitlement problem, those bonds will not be as valuable as they are right now.
Oh, nonsense.
Anyone that looks at the trajectory of the entitlements, that in 2045 they will consume our entire tax revenue, must understand
that you can't say things like that that you know are not true and just expect that I'm going to ignore it. That is assuming that we continue to be in a recession. That is assuming that there are no tax increases. That is assuming that Medicare continues to have a $600 gift to Big Pharma. I'm sorry.
Do you want tax increases on, you know, the middle class and everyone?
No, I want to get out of this. I want to get out of this the same way that Andrew Jackson and subsequent presidents, Ulysses Grant and so on, got out of the debt after the Civil War, which was much greater than 100% of GDP, and the same way that Dwight Eisenhower got us out of the World War II debt, which was 127% of GDP. We're only at 70% of GDP
our debt is right now, Tom. What I'm worried about is the $80 trillion in unfunded liabilities.
Well, you can worry about that, Jamie,
Medicare,
but the
Medicaid,
rest of us,
and Social Security.
You can worry about that all day long, but those are phony. Let me reassure you. Let me just reassure you. Those are phony numbers.
Those are phony numbers.
I could say, okay, let's assume that the economy is just as hot as it was in the last year of the Clinton administration, and that the tax rates are exactly where they are right now, and unemployment is just as low as it is in the Clinton administration, you will have no entitlement program problems. None.
That's nonsense.
No,
it's all the assumptions that you base those numbers on.
It's entirely the assumptions. You can grow your way out of debt.
Yeah, not the serious type of growth that you have in Medicare.
Oh,
at this point. Serious budget people, no one thinks that, Tom. They understand that unless you address entitlement reform, we are in serious trouble
as a
nation.
That's nonsense.
And it has to be done.
That is the stuff that Pete Peterson has spent $400 million trying to shove down the throat of America because he and his Wall Street buddies want to get their hands on Social Security.
You think he does that for fun, spending $400
million? I think he does that because he and his buddies know how much profit they will make if Social Security is privatized.
Peterson is an old man at this point, who has over $1 billion, I think probably $2 billion, maybe even more. He hardly needs to spend $400 million of his own money to try to make more profit for himself.
So you're suggesting that maybe Pete Peterson could get by on just $1 billion?
Can he get by on $1 billion?
Right.
Of course.
Okay, so let's tax all his wealth over $1 billion at 100%.
Tom, are you actually advocating that?
Well, you just suggested that he would be fine with that.
Yes,
I am advocating that.
That would do almost zero to solve any problem that we have.
It just
wouldn't solve anything. I mean, it's not a good policy to begin with. But besides that, it doesn't solve anything.
Thomas Jefferson suggested that when wealth becomes so great that it threatens democracy,
it should be taxed.
Pete Peterson has spent $400 billion to get people like you waking up in the middle of the night thinking that there's a $70 billion entitlement crisis literally 70 years down the road when there isn't.
Why? You're applying nefarious motivations to Pete Peterson. Maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. I think he's right. But the reason he's doing it, obviously, is because he actually believes it's a threat. No one spends $400 million for fun. No one spends that. That's your number. I mean, I'm assuming that you're right there. No one spends that because
they get
kicks and giggles and are thinking to make some more money from it.
How do you know?
Because they're worried.
How do you know?
Because it just makes no sense that he would spend $400 million to somehow make more money, which I'm not even sure how he would in that instance. I think he's doing it because he believes it's a great threat to this country. As almost anyone who's a budget analyst who looks at this issue.
I think that's tragic.
I think our trajectory is
tragic.
Because
all you have to do is look at the history of this country and what you see, and the rest of the world for that matter. And what you see is that when Republican austerity measures are applied, as You know, read Wolfgang Munchau's op-ed in yesterday's Financial Times. It's probably in the print edition today, about how American Republicans want to go down the road that Greece and Spain just went down, and it's insane. You don't cut your way out of a crisis. You grow your way out of a crisis.
Greece got in trouble through austerity. That was their problem to begin with.
And austerity is the Republican prescription. It's what you're talking about, cutting spending. Austerity is cutting spending.
You're saying that the reason Greece got to where it was is because of austerity?
No, I'm saying the reason they got so much worse is because of austerity. The reason they got where they were is because most of their billionaires were not paying their taxes.
Well, here, how about this, Tom? I would be amenable, because I don't think the current spending is as much of a problem. I think it's a problem, but not nearly as much of a problem.
Our spending is at lows that we haven't seen since the Eisenhower administration.
Our entitlements, and then I will not be as worried about our current spending, which is really serious, but what's actually serious is our long-term fiscal spending.
Jamie, you don't even need sleeping pills. Just relax. It's going to be fine. You don't have to worry about
this. You see the smiles, Tom? I'm not that worried.
I thought you were really worried. I mean, you were even telling me, you know. Okay, Jamie Weinstein, you can read his writings over at dailycaller.com. He's brilliant. He's got a lot of really great stuff there. And his book, The Lizard King, is a super read. Jamie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, people wake up in the middle of the night worrying about entitlement? Really? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tom in Yonkers, New York. Listening on WMMS. Where is that?
WMNF. That's okay.
Okay.
I was screaming at the radio when you were talking to this guy, and he was wondering why Pete Peterson would give $400 million to his Pete Peterson Foundation to do this. And it's a 501c3. That money was tax deductible. It lowered his taxes while pushing his political agenda.
Oh.
At the same time.
Yeah. Okay, that makes a certain amount of sense. And
that's why he does it.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's a part of, you know, Ari Fleischer is now, you know, tweeting about how, you know, after your first $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year of income, your ability to deduct charitable contributions starts going down. And I wonder if that's kind of the Pete Peterson tax that's slipped in there by the administration. If so, good on them.
So next time somebody asks you that question, you have a ready answer.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate the call. That was brilliant. Jim in Waxahachie, Texas. Hey, Jim, it says you disagree with me. There's no such thing as a tax cut. Really?
Yeah, sure. There is only the tax rate that we pay. Now, you can raise and lower the tax rate, but you don't really, per se, cut it. We're not paying the Bush-era tax cut. We're paying the Bush-era tax rate and the now Obama-era tax rate.
Okay. All right. It's a semantic point, but one with which I don't disagree. And we're all also paying the...
And then I just had one other question, too.
Sure.
How does it cost money to fund a tax cut? Wouldn't that be assuming that the government is owner of all of our money and... By changing the tax rate one way or another, they're allowing us to keep more of our money in the first place?
Well, it's sort of like, let's say you've got a job that pays you $1,000 a month and your rent is $800 a month and your house and your car and food cost you $200 a month. So right now your income and your expenses are the same, you know, just in this
Correct.
Obviously idiotic example. It doesn't include a lot of things, but and then your income, your employer says, you know, we can't afford $1,000 a month anymore. Your income is going to go down to $800 a month. So now you've got a $200 a month deficit. So you have a couple of choices. You can start putting on your credit card, which is what most Americans did for the first, you know, few years, the late 90s and early 2000s. And then you can say,
or
okay,
you move to a lifestyle that's more within your.
Or you can say my home has some value. Well, people are trying to hang on to their same house, and you know the home has some value, so I'll put a second mortgage on it. Or third, you could sell, like you said, you could sell your house and you could rent, and there's a lot of wisdom.
Or you know, pick up an extra job.
Okay, so using that as the metaphor, even though it's you know trying to compare family finances to government finances is a bad idea because governments can create money out of thin air and families can't. But, you know, using that metaphor in any case, The example would be, let's instead of moving, in, you know, selling our house and moving into a rental property, let's try and find a job that pays $1,000 a month. Hello?
Or $1,600 a month to cover what you were cut.
Yeah.
I see where you're going with this. All right.
Well, I'm saying, you know, you could do it on either side of the equation. It's very simple. And you know, we cut almost $2 trillion in spending last year with no tax offsets at all. Obama did that to
spending or
that was actual spending. It's spending over a 10-year period, but it's actual spending. It was almost $2 trillion that was cut last year. That was part of that deal that Obama made in order to extend Medicare. You know, the Republicans were holding hostage the debt ceiling of Medicare. And so Obama agreed to almost $2 trillion in spending cuts and no tax increases. So now he just asked for $1.2 trillion in tax increases. He got $600 billion. So we're still, you know, if you're talking about one-to-one, about balance, then we still have to raise at least another $1.6 or $1.8 billion in tax revenue over a 10-year period. And that's not all that hard to do, frankly. You could do the entire thing simply by saying that Mitt Romney and Paris Hilton have to pay the same income tax rate as my wife's surgeon.
Well, technically, they're paying rates twice if you're talking about.
No, they're not.
Because first they're
Paris Hilton is not paying any tax twice. The money that she gets from her family's from the dividends on her family's stock, she never paid tax on that.
No, she didn't, but the family did. The money itself was.
Okay, so are you suggesting that when I pay a paycheck to Shano, who, you know, our associate producer here, that I should not be deducting his payroll taxes to give to the federal government because as a small business, I've already paid taxes on that, our corporate business tax?
I don't know. I pay my own taxes. I don't know what it's like to have someone pay a portion for me.
Well, do you have any employees?
No, I'm just self-employed. Drive a truck all by myself.
Okay. So if a company writes you a check for your services to drive your truck, do you think that you can go to the IRS and make the argument that you should not have to pay income taxes because that company paid taxes on that money before they wrote you the check?
Oh, no, I have to pay the income taxes.
So why shouldn't Paris Hilton pay the exact same income tax when her source of revenue is dividends from family stock and your source of revenue is from working your butt off? Why shouldn't she pay the same tax that you pay?
Valid point, I suppose. But
well, the argument that Rush Limbaugh will tell you is that the corporation, if it's, let's say it's Hilton stock, I don't know if Paris Hilton's, you know, if her last name is actually because she's associated with the family or not. I thought, you know, Joel High, whatever, or Penny Pritzker.
I disagree with all the loopholes that the corporations get into, but we blind ourselves to the fact that it's our politicians that make deals with the corporations, and they should both be held equally liable. Instead of trying to
no, but that's not the point that I'm making. The point that I'm making is that we could solve our problems if we simply said that Paris Hilton and Mitt Romney, who make their money sitting on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive, when that money comes to them from the company, whether the company paid taxes or not, and one quarter of all profitable major corporations in America pay no taxes whatsoever, so you can't even make the argument that dividends are double taxed. But in any case, that when those, you know, when that money is paid out as dividends, that should be the same thing as ordinary income. It should be the same as a truck driver's income.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This double taxation thing is something that the toadies of the billionaires have come up with to sell the average working person on supporting billionaires being billionaires. Bad and the very, very habromaniacally ugly, the good. Alabama State Representative Patricia Todd, a Democrat, by the way. Todd, Alabama's first openly gay legislator, has introduced a bill that would repeal the state's existing sex education law, which requires teachers to teach that homosexuality is illegal and that, quote, abstinence from sexual intercourse outside of lawful marriage is the expected social standard, end quote. The bill would strike requirements that teachers emphasize, quote, homosexuality is not a lifestyle acceptable to the general public, and that homosexual conduct is a criminal offense, end quote. Time for the LGBT community to be embraced by society, not vilified by it. Let's hope Ms. Todd's bill gets passed in Alabama and that it's just the beginning of a larger movement. The bad, Michael Savage. On Sunday, the conservative radio host told fellow radio show host Aaron Klein that, quote, we need a nationalist party in the United States of America. Savage went on to argue that the Tea Party isn't strong enough and that, quote, they need to restructure their party. They need a charismatic leader, which they don't have. In the interview, Savage also attacked the Republican Party, calling it, quote, an appendage of the Democrat machine. Sorry, Michael, I don't think that an appendage of the Democrat machine would hold critical legislation hostage, time after time, hurting the livelihoods of millions of Americans in the process. And the very, very ugly, Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas. Despite not being on the job for a week yet, Senator Cruz is already making it clear why he is a Tea Party favorite. Appearing on Fox News Sunday yesterday, Cruz made it clear that he doesn't approve of compromise in Washington. Cruz said that, quote, I don't think that what Washington needs is more compromise. I think what Washington needs is more common sense and more principle. Basically, Cruz wants to continue the pattern of Republican obstructionism. In the interview, Cruz also said that he's against compromise when it comes to gun control legislation as well. Cruz said that attempts to introduce new gun control measures are entirely unconstitutional. Senator Cruz is in favor of holding the nation hostage to score political points and sees nothing wrong with letting thousands of Americans die every year from totally preventable gun violence, and that is very, very ugly. So, amazing. Hang on. Excuse me. I am back. So, let's see here. Derek, listening on KBCS in Seattle, our one of our newest affiliates. Hey, Daryl, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to make a comment about the comment that you made about students and younger people not being present at political rallies and protests because we're running scared.
Well, that the Chris Hedges is suggesting that it may not be that there's that exact cause and effect right at the moment with regard to the government tracking students, that they're afraid that they won't be able to get jobs, but that certainly that's something that is going to start being touted. You know, if you're in the government database, don't expect to get a job here. That kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to make a comment. Our local branch of the Occupy movement is rather disorganized, and several times I've entertained and talked to some of the people involved in that process in the possibility of joining it, and that threat of or that sort of guillotine of being labeled as a protester and possibly labeled it, you know, as a domestic terrorist in this new climate of anti-protest attitudes is absolutely a factor, not only among myself, but also among many of my friends in how we would choose to voice our support or opposition to any given issue.
So you are among those who are genuinely concerned that by joining the Occupy movement, you'd end up in the FBI database, local police database, and that a year from now, a decade from now, a job that might be a really important job to you might be denied to you because you're in that government database, and therefore you've restrained yourself.
Absolutely. The training I'm going for right now is in a corporate or corporatized business. I'm going into video game design, and it's become in the last 10 years a very corporatized business, and that is a very real fear for me and for a lot of my friends at school. They don't want to become involved in the political process because of how galvanized we've all become between the middle class and corporate America.
Right. That's tragic, Derek. It really is. I absolutely understand it, and thank you for sharing your perspective with us. I just have to say, though, this is what America's come to. It's just genuinely tragic. Thank you very much for the call. Robert in Jonesville, Louisiana. Hey, Robert. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
You're on the air, sir.
Hello.
Yes, sir. You are on the air.
Yeah, John. Listen, I'm calling. I used to be Republican. I'm a Democrat now.
Mm-hmm.
But I just can't understand how, like Louisiana, all the red or Texas, the red states, they're against anything that like the Republican. Like right now, we got Bobby Jindal as governor of Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And they're against the Obamacare thing. Well, you take the red states. There, I mean, I'm a self-employed business, but I know of people that really need food stamps, and old people need Social Security and stuff like that. And the Republicans, like on Fox News, they're lying to the people. They just say entitlement cuts. Well, the older people, like my mother, for instance, she watches Fox News. She don't even know what entitlement means. And I had to explain to her, Mama, that's what Social Security means. It's something you're entitled to, something that you work for all your life. And they're trying to cut Social Security. They're trying to cut Medicare. Oh, well, I didn't know that. But see, on the Fox News, they don't go into detail and explain it to the people what entitlement benefits mean.
That's right.
And, you know, and a lot of people that are Republican, and they're up in age and stuff, they don't understand what entitlement really means.
Yeah, they're what the Republicans refer to as low-information voters.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And then they got this group, they're going around, I've seen on there, they call it For Freedom. And, you know, and then they got other benefits, other organizations off of that, you know, the Tea Party and different things like that. But anyway, I just wanted to clarify that a lot of people, they need to make it known what entitlements mean for the older people because they don't understand.
You're absolutely right. Robert, thank you very much for the call. And as much as I could have done it, you just did a brilliant job of sharing that with at least 3 million people. So good on you. Robert, thank you for the call. Greg in Jackson Springs, North Carolina. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So much of what you've been talking about is really what... based on what I want to say, and it's the confusion of the voters, it's the confusion of the American public on how our tax system works.
Mm-hmm.
So many of my friends and workers, people that I work with here in the Pinehurst area, North Carolina, do not simply understand that the highest tax rate for anybody is applied only to dollars that are above a certain amount of money.
Right.
That the first dollars that they earn, they are not paying at that high tax rate.
That's right. Yeah, if somebody makes $450,000 a year under the new tax code, they're actually not paying even $1 at the 39.6% rate. Their first $10,000, they're paying nothing on. Their second $10,000 or $15,000, they're paying 5% or 10%, you know, whatever. I don't have the tax tables in front of me, but you're absolutely right. And people think, you know, the way it's sold, the way that the millionaires and billionaires and Republicans sell it is, as soon as you hit $450,000, your taxes go up as if all of your income is taxed at that high rate. It's not.
That's right. And you say low-information voters, but these low-information voters are not necessarily ignorant people.
No, they're not. There's just not good information in the media now because ever since Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, we've gone from news to infotainment.
Very, very good point. One other thing, Tom, that came across me the other day, and it's all got to do with this tax issue and entitlements. I was born in 1951. And the other day I was thinking about all the military actions that we've taken since 1951. And just, I came up with, I think it's 10, double figures. And it seems to me that what I fear is one of the reasons that we can't afford to take care of our own people is because we have to be available to, or have the funds available to continue with the type of military actions that we've taken since 1951,
mm-hmm.
which, in my opinion, if you look back at them, starting with the Korean War and Vietnam and invading Grenada and Panama and the two Iraq wars and Afghanistan, and none of these things have done anything to make me safer in my life in the United States.
Well, in fact, the contrary. They have made us less safe. Blowback is the famous word. I mean, the reason why Osama bin Laden created al-Qaeda and went off on jihad against the United States was twofold. And he was very clear about this. You can read this in the collected writings of Osama bin Laden, which is in print. The reason was twofold. Number one, we built an Air Force base in Saudi Arabia to kick Kuwait out of Iraq. George Bush Sr. did this. And in that Air Force base, you had men drinking alcohol and women running around showing their elbows. And he thought that's the desecration of sacred ground. And number two, because we were buying oil from Saudi Arabia at less than $100 a barrel, he thought we were stealing their resources. It was blowback. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Time after time after time, what we've seen is that our military adventures have just, you know, created more of the same. They've been disasters. And let's check in with the news, the real news, a real news agency, the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Victoria Jones on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Great to hear your voice. So what's going on in the world? And see your smiling face.
Oh, thank you very much. Supreme Court news. Mm-hmm. The justices announced today they will hear arguments in two cases affecting gay marriage. In March, and I just turned off my video by mistake. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's quite all right.
Two cases in March, on March the 26th and March the 27th, respectively.
Mm-hmm.
The first case involves California's constitutional amendment that forbids same-sex marriage, and the second concerns a federal law that denies gay couples who legally marry the right to obtain federal benefits available to heterosexual married couples.
Which is
so
basically DOMA.
Yes, DOMA.
So they're going to determine whether the constitutional ban on gay marriage in California and or the ban on gay marriage in California, the whole thing that the Mormon Church put all that money into stopping the overturn of, and whether DOMA are constitutional. Any sense of which way they're going to go on this? I know that this isn't totally a left-right issue. It's more of a libertarian versus bigot issue in some ways. I'm not sure how else to describe it.
Just on third blush, because first blush was when I first looked at this a while ago, and I haven't looked at it recently, is that probably they may well go against the idea of completely allowing same-sex marriage. The California case is complicated, and it gives them the option for some narrow rulings. So they could go narrow on that and maybe sort of, not exactly dodge it, but, mm-hmm.
So they can go Solomonic and split the baby.
But DOMA, I think it's quite possible that they could throw DOMA out.
That would be very interesting. And even though there's I refer to them as five right-wing crazies on the court, and Scalia is on record as saying that laws against homosexuality are perfectly constitutional in his opinion. I'm not sure that John Roberts would agree with that, although maybe he would. I mean, he's very religious, or at least he seems to be. Anthony Kennedy might be a wavering.
He's the interesting vote in so many of these things. He seems to have unusual power for one justice.
Anthony Kennedy?
Yes.
Yeah, well, he's essentially the swing vote. He's the guy that got dragged in. I'm guessing that Clarence Thomas would go along with the right-wingers.
I'm thinking.
And probably Sam Alito would.
Yes.
So it's probably going to come down to Kennedy. That's going to be
Although weird. Alito sometimes surprises you.
Yeah. Yeah. And as time goes on, actually, he surprises you more and more.
Yes.
It's sort of like Earl Warren. You know, he started out as this very conservative justice appointed by a Republican and then became the enemy of the John Birch Society, with I think it was Brown v. Board was the first thing that really, upset them about him and got them putting impeach Earl Warren signs all over the country. Anyhow.
One other Supreme Court story, which is the Supreme Court decided today it will not review a challenge to federal funding of human embryonic stem cell research. So that allows human embryonic stem cell research studies to proceed. They rejected an appeal from two scientists who said stem cell research violates federal law banning the creation and destruction of human embryos for scientific purposes.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting, too,
yes.
Because, you know, the right-wing five are also Catholic, and that's, you know, banning stem cell research is something the Catholic Church is all gung-ho for.
Yeah.
And more often than not entirely, but more often than not, these five justices seem to vote their religion. Although, you know, within the Catholic Church, there's a huge schism on this issue, on stem cell research. Because
they just decline to hear it, so it will go forward, and that's the end of that. So that's very interesting. Well, not necessarily, but in this case, it's the end of that. Yeah. Also today, President Obama nominated Republican former Senator Chuck Hagel from Nebraska to be his next defense secretary. Mm-hmm. Also John Brennan, his counterterrorism advisor, to be the head of the CIA. He said Chuck Hagel is the leader that our troops deserve. He's an American patriot. He enlisted in our army, volunteered for Vietnam, and first as a private, then as a sergeant. He served with honor alongside his own brother. Interestingly, Hagel has given an interview to the Lincoln Journal Star and has said that his record has been completely distorted, and an accurate assessment will demonstrate unequivocal total support for Israel and endorsement of tough international economic sanctions against Iran.
Right.
He says he wants a fair hearing.
Yeah, I think he once used the phrase Jewish lobby when he meant Israeli lobby, and that 1.5 second lapse in a 20-year political career has apparently cost him dearly. I'm willing to give him an absolute pass on all this stuff, but the thing I'm curious about is why nobody has asked him about his stint as the CEO of a voting machine company that became ES&S, the second largest in the country.
It's interesting that it hasn't come up yet. Maybe there's somebody on the Senate Armed Services Committee that will get to it.
I wonder if the
hearing.
Republicans are worried about the former CEO of a voting machine company being inside the White House.
Ooh, interesting.
So, who knows? Anyhow, what else is up?
Also, a report out today from the Bipartisan Policy Center, which is generally respected by both sides, estimates the nation is going to begin defaulting on its payment obligations between February the 15th and March the 1st. In other words, we could face a debt ceiling crisis as early as mid-February.
Right. In other words, two and a half weeks from now. By the way, did you know that Chuck Hagel was a talk show host before he was the CEO of a voting machine company?
I did not know that.
Yep. Yep. He was a talk show host in Nebraska, and then he became the CEO of what is now ES&S, and then he ran for the United States Senate, and in what the Washington Post described as the upset victory of the year nationwide, won even African-American districts that had never voted Republican when they all voted on his company's
blunt,
machines.
You know, so I think it's going to be a very lively confirmation hearing. Yeah. It'd be worth watching with popcorn.
I agree. I think it's going to be fascinating. I'm just doubtful that any of this part of his past is going to come up. I frankly think that Hagel... My take on Hagel is that he could do, you know, Nixon could go to China because he was a Republican. Hagel could take on he could help fix the Israel situation because he's a Republican. We'll see. But anyhow, Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast on television on both the Dish via the Free Speech TV network, on both Dish Network and DirecTV to all of North America, and cable systems nationwide here in the United States. I've heard this probably 6 or 7 times now in the last couple of weeks. I believe every single time on National Public Radio, various shows where in attempts to have, quote, balance, unquote, they get on these commentators from the Cato Institute or the Heritage Foundation or other Koch brothers or other right-wing funded think tanks. And the people inevitably say things like this. Here is Chris Edwards, for example. This isn't a clip from NPR. It's a clip from, I beg your pardon? It's this is a clip from his testimony before Congress, but it's the exact same sentiment. Here's Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute.
Other countries have cut spending when they've got into crisis. We see cuts in the UK right now. And I think Canadian reforms in the mid-1990s are a real model that we can look at. In the mid-90s, Canadian government spending was up to 53% of GDP. Their debt was exploding. Then their Liberal government really changed course, and they chopped spending from their federal budget 10% in 2 years, which would be like us chopping $370 billion in just 2 years. Then they held spending flat for a number of years after that. And the result was dramatic.
Yeah, and dramatic and positive, and I like I said, I've heard this repeatedly here on NPR and here in the United States, and which is a major news source for a lot of Americans. I don't watch a lot of network television. I'm assuming the same thing is happening there. Obviously, this is the talking point du jour. So I wanted to reality check this with a real Canadian economist who can tell us what's actually going on, what went on in Canada, what the consequences were, how it's played out. Dr. James Stanford is with us. He's an economist with the Canadian Auto Workers. CAW.ca is their website. And he's the founder of the Progressive Economics Forum and the author of a book called Economics for Everyone, A Short Guide to the Economics of Capitalism. And the website for that, economicsforeveryone.ca. And Dr. Stanford, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
Thanks so much for joining us. First of all, was what Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute said accurate?
Well, obviously he's telling the part of the story that suits his agenda. I mean, the part that he forgot is that the federal government here and the provincial governments spend enormously on a whole set of public programs such as single-payer health care and public higher education and other programs. That benefit our economy and benefit our society. It is certainly the case that the federal government cut back its spending during the mid-1990s, I think unnecessarily so. The budget deficit very quickly turned into a budget surplus, but it wasn't mostly because of the spending cuts. It was largely because in the mid-90s, the Canadian economy, the underlying real economy, if you like, really took off. And that generated all the tax revenues that allowed the deficit to be eliminated and then replaced with surpluses for some years. Now, of course, we're going through another exercise in austerity. Canada, like other countries, including the United States, of course, is facing demands from folks like Mr. Edwards to cut our spending even further. But I don't think the Canadian experience of the mid-90s in any way whatsoever justifies the sort of unthinking austerity that we're seeing in Europe and America and elsewhere these days.
What astounds me is that here in the United States, we have had the experience of, in particular after the Civil War and after World War II, to some extent after World War I, we have had the experience of coming out of a national crisis wildly in debt, far worse than the debt that we have as a result of 32 years of Reaganomics. I mean, we're at about 70% of GDP our debt is right now. I believe Canada's is actually higher than that. Correct me if I'm wrong. And
well, the federal debt in Canada is lower, but we have provinces that are able to take on their own debt.
I see.
Unlike in your case, where the states are required generally to run balanced budgets. So
right, yeah.
If you put the two levels of government together in debt, in Canada, the debt is indeed higher.
Oh, okay. In fact, Vermont is, I believe, the only state in the United States that doesn't have a constitutional requirement for a balanced budget, and they have a balanced budget in any case. But the thing that astounds me is that we've had the experience in this country many times of coming out of a national crisis badly in debt and not cutting our way to prosperity, but growing our way to prosperity. The 15, 20 year period after the Civil War, it's a period of incredible growth. The late 1860s, the 1870s, the early 1880s before the Great Crash, and the period after World War II, Eisenhower building a national highway system. After the Great Depression, for that matter, although that didn't so much involve debt. Why the drumbeat in our country and in your country to respond to debt by cutting expenses rather than increasing revenue by putting people back to work?
Mm-hmm. No, you're quite right to ask that question, Tom. The way I put it as an economist is like this. You think of any fraction. Every fraction has a numerator and a denominator. And I think it's in about grade 4 math you learn that there's two ways to alter the size or value of the fraction. One is to change the numerator. If you want a higher fraction, you grow the numerator. Or vice versa, you can shrink the denominator and have exactly the same effect. This is how it works in the how to measure debt. Debt should not be measured in dollars. That means nothing until you consider the ability to service the debt, which is depends on your economy and how much income you produce. So the relevant measure is what's called the debt to GDP ratio, which is a fraction. The debt is in the top of the fraction, the numerator. The GDP is in the bottom. And historical experience shows it's much faster and more effective to reduce the debt burden by growing that denominator, by growing GDP. Canada did exactly the same thing after World War II. Like the United States, we entered a kind of a golden age of two or three decades of very strong investment, strong growth, higher income. And lo and behold, our debt shrank from over 100% of GDP at the end of World War II to barely 10% of GDP by the early 1970s. Not because we cut spending and not because we paid back any of the debt, purely because we grew the economy and therefore our ability to service the debt. And that is exactly what happened in the mid-90s, that period of Canadian history that the Cato Institute spokesperson was speaking of. As a result of a few factors, lower interest rates, low value for the Canadian dollar, strong growth in many of our export-oriented manufacturing industries, the growth of the Canadian economy really picked up in the late 1990s, and that overwhelmingly is what drove the deficit reduction. And so we did move from quite a large deficit, frankly, in the early 90s to surpluses by 1997, in fact, far ahead of the schedule for the budget timetable.
Now, we were seeing similar surpluses here in the United States, and they've been attributed to Clinton raising taxes on wealthy people. Were they actually more the consequence of lower unemployment, more people working, making more money?
In the Canadian setting, you're thinking?
No, in the United States, do you know?
Oh, in the United States. No, I think in the U.S. as well, you could clearly show that it was economic growth that was the dominant driver. The taxes, which in the Clinton era were very modest, obviously paid a contributing factor. In the Canadian case, we had very modest tax increases as well in the mid-90s. If you were to ascribe the burden of deficit reduction in that period, it was at least 80% aimed at spending cuts and perhaps 20% through some very modest tax increases, which were subsequently rolled back as soon as the balanced budget was attained. But that's a kind of, a simple arithmetic way of trying to explain what happened. Right. What was really driving deficit reduction was the strong growth in job creation.
It's the growth in job creation. We're talking with Dr. James Stanford, an economist with the Canadian Auto Workers, founder of Progressive Economics Forum. We'll be right back with more of Dr. Stanford.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He's also the author of the book Economics for Everyone, A Short Guide to the Economics of Capitalism, economicsforeveryone.ca. Welcome back to Talk Media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour. We're talking this hour with Dr. James Stanford. He is an economist with the Canadian Auto Workers, CAW.ca. He is the founder of the Progressive Economics Forum in Canada and the author of Economics for Everyone, A Short Guide to the Economics of Capitalism. Economicsforeveryone.ca is that website. And is there a website for the Progressive Economics Forum, sir?
There is, yes. It's progressive-economics.ca.
Okay.
And that is a network of, more progressive-thinking economists in Canada. We have a blog site that's quite active and some other resources there.
Okay. So here in the United States, we have a situation where roughly half of all bankruptcies, and it's, well over a million a year, roughly half of all bankruptcies in the United States are because somebody in the family got sick. And more than half of those are in families where there was health insurance. And on top of that, we have more student loan debt in the United States, over $1 trillion, than we have credit card debt. We have kids graduating from college with student loan debts that they literally will not finish paying off until they're in their 40s and 50s. Forget about buying a house and starting to build equity. Is that the situation in Canada?
No, not at all. And those are some of the indicators where the contrast between Canada and the United States is still crystal clear. The number of families driven to bankruptcy for health reasons in Canada would be close to zero. I won't say it's zero. There are still cases where individuals experience a certain disease, and the thing that could bankrupt them in Canada is the cost of specialized prescription drugs. The actual health coverage, any core medical treatment, hospitalization, surgery, and so on is all covered by the public system. But the prescription drug side of things is not yet. We're trying to get it included within the public system, but so far you still pay for that out of pocket. So if you had no insurance through your employer or no personal insurance, you could still be facing some enormous bills. Now, there is a safety net, a kind of a second-class charity type of system in most provinces that will help you there. Mm-hmm. So in most cases, you'd never have an individual or a family go bankrupt for health reasons. You still can suffer some obviously enormous financial pressures due to inability to work and so on, but right. We have the basics in place on that one.
Right. Okay, so we were talking about how, first of all, this Cato Institute meme that they are pushing aggressively now in the United States. I've just been hearing this for the last 2 weeks over and over and over again. The Canada cut spending in the 1990s, and as a consequence of that, their economy took off and grew. You're suggesting that that was coincident with a growth in the economy, just like it was here in the United States, and that the growth of the economy, did you have a dot-com bubble up there like we did here? Is that what was driving the thing?
No, the dot-com bubble actually came a little bit later. We did have a wicked recession in the early 90s that in part was self-inflicted. I know that there was a recession in the United States at the same time, but the one in Canada was much worse, mm-hmm. partly because we had a group of really militant anti-inflation people running our central bank at the time. Right. So they drove up interest rates very high, and that also drove up the Canadian currency very high on international markets and really contributed to a serious recession. It was kind of the reversal of those factors. The central bank was forced to lower interest rates very dramatically, and the currency fell, so our export-oriented industries took off. The dot-com bubble did come along later in the 90s, but it was not as important in Canada as it was in the United States. Right. We're a bit less of a financialized system. So there, you know, there were certainly some of that euphoria, if you like, but the majority of it was real, and that is what drove the deficit reduction at that time. I'm surprised the Cato Institute doesn't talk about some of the other Canadian examples. One that would be much more timely would be to talk about Canadian banking regulations, which are very strong, have a very strong role for government in the banking system. And that's much more important in explaining why Canada's fiscal situation is better than America's today, because we didn't have the same bank collapses and then subsequent public bailout of the banks that you did in the U.S.
Yeah, you had none of the above. And by the way, for our viewers and listeners, I hadn't mentioned this, and I will. We will be taking listener calls and viewer calls for Dr. Stanford right after the break at the bottom of the hour. So if you have a question you'd like general economics, he's a brilliant economist in general, or specifically about Canada, feel free. One question that's not so much economics, but we mentioned healthcare, and I'd just like to get your take on this. I get calls every week from Americans who claim to know somebody in Canada who died or got gangrene or whatever because they tried to get in to see their doctor, tried to go to the hospital, and they got put on a waiting list, and the Canadian national healthcare system or the province by province, you know, whatever, is just this horrible thing that we in America should totally avoid. And the proof of it is that you deliver healthcare in Canada for half the cost of what we deliver healthcare for here in the United States. Any truth to all that?
No, I mean, I don't want to portray Canada as a perfect or a nirvana or utopia or anything like that. We've got some tremendous problems and challenges here, but that sort of stuff is just lies. That's sheer propaganda. The Canadian health system works very well. There's nobody who dies of gangrene because they can't get treated. Any medically urgent condition will get immediate attention in a free emergency room, a free public hospital,
all of which are very high quality. So that's just propaganda. And the proof of that is obviously in health outcomes, which are much better in Canada by any measure, whether that's infant mortality, life expectancy, and so on. So yeah. The system is not perfect. We need to make improvements to it. The one I mentioned is to bring the prescription drug piece of it under the umbrella of the single-payer system. Right. That has to happen. But there's no way that Canadians are dying because they can't get treatment.
Well, and even there, prescription drugs are a fraction of what they are here in the United States. Bernie Sanders used to organize busloads of Vermonters to go up there, up to Montreal to buy their drugs. So, Dr. Stanford, we have to take our bottom-of-the-hour break here. We will be back in 5 or 6 minutes with Dr. James Stanford. We'll be taking your calls for him as well. He's an economist with the Canadian Auto Workers, CAW.ca. He's the founder of Progressive Economics Forum, progressive-economics.ca, and the author of Economics for Everyone, economicsforeveryone.ca.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm curious to get his thoughts not only on Canada and the United States, but also just the general future of the Western economies of the world. Canada. There you go. Welcome back. And Dr. James Stanford is with us. He's an economist with the Canadian Auto Workers Union, CAW.ca, the founder of the Progressive Economics Forum, progressive-economics.ca, and author of Economics for Everyone, a short guide to the economics of capitalism, economicsforeveryone.ca. And welcome back, Dr. Stanford.
Pleasure to be here.
I am curious, just in general, in my Canadian questions. I've been for a long time wanting to talk to an economist. I love talking to economists from other countries to find out how they work relative to the United States. We had tariffs here on imported goods in the United States, which largely kept manufacturing in our country from 1793 until they began to diminish with the Reagan administration, arguably the tail end of the Carter administration. And then, you know, really the death knell of it was during the Clinton administration. To what extent has Canada done the same thing, or and do you have a VAT tax there? And is that used as essentially a reverse tariff by applying it to imported goods and removing it from exported goods the way that China, Taiwan, Germany, you know, so many other export-driven economies do?
Mm-hmm. Well, we do face the same challenges of globalization and the thinking behind free trade agreements in Canada. There's no doubt about it. Our tariffs have been eliminated. And I think more importantly, our sort of overall industrial policies, if you like, some of the other measures, the structural measures that governments would put in place in order to make sure that we had some of those high value, high wage jobs, those have eroded. So our manufacturing sector in the 90s actually did pretty well. Partly because of the low dollar at that time, the low Canadian dollar, and partly because of our healthcare system. Here's another benefit of our healthcare system. Because the cost of healthcare fall on the public sector rather than on employers, that was a big labor cost advantage, for companies to set up in Canada. In the last decade, though, our manufacturing sector has declined dramatically, for a number of reasons, including a big upsurge in the value of the Canadian dollar and the expansion of those free trade agreements. In terms of your question on the VAT tax, we do have them actually at both levels of government. The federal government has a sales tax, and then most of the provinces have a sales tax as well. And yes, those are applied to imported goods. There's no tax placed on exported goods, so it does help a little bit in terms of the trade competitiveness issue. The main value of the VAT tax, though, is just another source of public revenue to help pay for that healthcare system and the education system and so on that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, earlier we were talking about healthcare. Here in the United States, we also have students who are graduating from college, you know, wiped out in debt. And for, you know, back, I'm a bit older, and you know, I mean, my college years were the early 70s, late 60s, and I didn't know anybody who had substantial college debt, you know, going into life, other than people who decided to go on to medical school, that sort of thing. And but basic, you know, undergrad education, you could, you know, my wife worked her way through college as a waitress at a Howard Johnson's. I did as a DJ, making $2.35 an hour, and working at Bob's Big Boy as a dishwasher and working in a gas station. I mean, you know, that's, you could go to college doing that back in the day. What does it cost to go to college in Canada, and what's the situation? I know that there was some student protests relative to this some while back.
Well, the protests were in Quebec, which is the system with the best and most accessible higher education system. There, the fees are very low. If you are born in Quebec and live there and paid taxes, you would only pay about $1,000 or $1,500 a year in your tuition fees. And the government, the kind of the conservative government at the time, was trying to increase those fees dramatically. In the rest of Canada, the fees are higher, but not on the U.S. scale. You'd be paying, say, $5,000 to $6,000 a year in tuition for your basic undergraduate program elsewhere in Canada. So, in a way, it's a matter of degree. I think we have a problem of excessive student debt in Canada. Once you pay for that tuition and your living costs for a year, a lot of students are graduating with debts that we consider high, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 at the end of a degree, but certainly not on the same same level of indebtedness as you've experienced. And then you get less of the financial costs as well. You get less bankruptcies here. You get graduates, once they do find a job, are able to put aside equity, buy a home, stabilize their family's finances, and so on. So in education, like in healthcare, I think the Canadian experience is clear that doing it publicly is not just fairer, it's actually more efficient in economic terms as well.
Is it true that Canada spends about half per capita of what the United States spends for healthcare, yet has better outcomes?
As a share of GDP, health spending in Canada, yeah, is about half of U.S. levels. And again, by those measures, Canadians are on average healthier. And that's despite the fact, Tom, that there's one other difference we haven't talked about. Canadian beer has 6% alcohol in it. So despite that, we have better health outcomes.
Yes, when my son was 19 years old and we were living in Vermont, he knew that.
He knew that well.
Yeah, you can drink when you're 18 in Canada, and it was just an hour across the border from... Okay. I shouldn't call out my kid, but he and his buddies... I have more questions for you, but let's get some caller questions in here as well. Mello in Addison, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You had a question about Canadian government spending for Dr. Stanford. Mello? Hello? No, Mello is apparently not listening. Okay, let's try Larry in Nutley, New Jersey. You had a question for Dr. Stanford.
I want to ask him about Canadian gold mining companies' involvement in Central America. But first, a quick shout out that on the subject of Canadian beer, the syntax on alcohol in Canada is also known for driving up home brewing. And as a home brewer, that's something I'm into and think that's great about Canada.
Okay.
So I was wondering to what extent he has been following efforts to hold companies like Pacific Rim accountable for the pollution that they've been causing through gold mining using arsenic, cyanide, basically destroying the livelihood of people to work their land in Central American countries, okay, as well as the attempt by Pacific Rim to sue the Salvadoran government for breach of contract under CAFTA.
Okay. Are you familiar with this, Dr. Stanford?
Yes, Larry is quite right to raise that as a concern. And as I mentioned, you know, Canadians aren't really a different species than Americans. We have our, we have our rich people. We have our power centers. We have our vested interests, people who put profit before ethics. And the Canadian mining industry is a very good example of that. Our economy is still somewhat underdeveloped in structural terms. Our manufacturing sector is relatively weak, as I said. But one area where Canadian companies are strong and where they're real global players is in the mining sector. So not just Central America, as Larry mentioned, but in Africa, in South America, Canadian companies have been very aggressive, using everything up to and including violence at their mines in terms of targeting union leaders or targeting community protesters. So the Canadian mining industry has a very bad ethical reputation that is a blot on our reputation as a country. And progressives at home in Canada are pushing to change our laws to hold Canadian-based companies more accountable,
not unlike
as well as supporting the operations and activists in other countries.
Not unlike American oil and mining companies as well.
Exactly.
I'm curious. I mentioned this macro question just before we hit the last break. We have about 3 minutes to the next one. What's your sense of what direction the world economy is going? Do you think that this austerity infection that seems to be traveling all around the world could bring us all down? Could we be heading for another Great Depression?
Well, I think in a way we already are in another depression, not in the sense of, you know, Dust Bowl poverty like the 1930s, but in the sense of a whole decade where the economy never really gained traction. And if you go back and look at the 30s, it wasn't like just static collapse. You did have your ups and downs. You did have years when it looked like you were starting to recover, but you never actually got going. You didn't get the momentum of a full-fledged recovery. And I think internationally we're experiencing something very much like that, a decade of stagnation. And the self-defeating logic of austerity that we see acutely in Europe, but we also see in America and Canada and elsewhere, is going to be a major reason for that. I just hope we find another way to cure this lost decade other than world war, which is how we cured the last lost decade.
Well, and I've had people come on and say to me, World War II is what got us out of the Great Depression. And my response is, so that's the amount of spending that we had to engage in to get us out of the Depression, because World War II is a massive government spending program.
Absolutely. And I say, let's do it again. Let's declare war. But this time, let's declare war on poverty and on global climate change and put the same sort of resources into addressing those challenges that we put into confronting fascism in World War II. And we'll get the same benefit of putting everyone back to work.
Yeah, and that benefit lasted for several generations after the end of World War II.
Absolutely.
Was it the same in Canada?
Oh, yes, certainly. We went from 30% unemployment to full employment within a year. We actually joined World War II a couple of years before you did, so the war effort geared up dramatically. And again, just like in America, we were, getting women to work in the formal sector. We were doing everything we could to get every able-bodied person on the job. And the incredible irony, Tom, is that people's living standards actually went up. It seems perverse, but you have a war and people's living standards went up just because you put people back to work.
Yeah, and it seems to be the key to everything. It's, as you pointed out, it's more important than raising taxes. It's more important than cutting spending. It's people having jobs. Dr. James Stanford will be right back with us in just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You can check out his book at economicsforeveryone.ca, his forum progressive-economics.ca, and, of course, the Canadian Auto Workers, CAW.ca. Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. James Stanford, an economist with the Canadian Auto Workers, CAW.ca, a founder of the Progressive Economics Forum, progressive-economics.ca, and author of Economics for Everyone, A Short Guide to the Economics of Capitalism, economicsforeveryone.ca. Did I get all that right, sir?
You sure did, Tom. Okay. You've got a good memory.
Okay. Well, part of it's written down here in front of me, so it helps. But the progressive economics, I was – in any case, we have some more listener and viewer calls as well. But let me just go to one right now here. David, listening on Sirius XM satellite radio in San Diego, California. David, you are on the air with Dr. James Stanford.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom, and I appreciate your tremendous intellect. I just wanted to talk about and use your example that you had mentioned earlier about the 1960s and 70s and being able to afford college on a very small budget. And the environment in the United States at that time was George Wallace standing in front of the public school system in Alabama, saying that blacks could not be a part of that situation. And I submit that that variable is not discussed, of the environment as opposed to the environment in Canada at that time, our environment, and what helped create the issues that we're under right now. So if blacks are and the Mexicans are going to go to school, we will have to raise the price of education. Or if this is going to have to be accepted in this new environment or this new America. This price will have to go up, or we will get our revenge in this way economically, which I think those systems put in place systemically with the government's help and state's help help create the environment that we live in today, that we're fighting about at this moment. It just so happened that obviously our cup runneth over and everyone is involved now and everyone is in the struggle. But it started out quite in complacent with other Americans that we're in this mess. And I don't believe that Canada had to deal with it under that. Could you speak to that issue, Tom, and sure. your guests?
Yeah, I should acknowledge my experience was, you know, being white in white America, you know, if, by and large. And you're right. There was a huge racial divide in the United States, and it still is. But back at that day, even a legal racial divide. Thank you, David. Dr. Stanford, your thoughts on David's comments?
I think David raises a very valid point. It is, I think, a historical and structural difference between Canada and the United States is the history of slavery in the United States and then the legacy of racism and sort of divide and conquer that has created. Again, I don't want to make it look like Canada's a nirvana. We have big problems with racism here, both against our First Nations people and against workers of color who came from elsewhere, including from the United States, fleeing slavery in the 1800s. But we do not have the same ability of the powers that be to kind of pit worker against worker that you've seen in the U.S. South, where those right to work for less laws began and now are kind of spreading their way northward. So I think the Canadian experience shows, again, both socially and economically, if you allow for full participation of everyone in education and in healthcare and in all the other institutions of society, there's economic benefits from that as well as obviously social and equity benefits.
To what purpose are conservative? I was in the previous hour. I had a fellow on from a conservative website whose intellect and good intentions I do not question. I raised this issue of this guy named Pete Peterson, who spent several hundred million dollars trying to privatize Social Security or trying to change American, you know, over decades, trying to change our view of Social Security so it could be privatized. And, his comment was, you know, Peterson clearly thinks that it's a genuine crisis. He's not in it for himself. What are the motives of the conservatives in Canada, either implicitly or explicitly, for moving down, you know, going down that lowest common denominator road that America has gone down of impoverishing our students, reducing access to health care, lowering the minimum wage, making union membership harder to get, things like that.
And privatizing Social Security, for that matter. Our system, our equivalent system here is called the Canada Pension Plan, CPP. And most conservatives here would prefer to see that downsized or even privatized altogether. I think there's a range of motives. I think many of them, as you mentioned, Tom, are motivated by a genuine belief and a genuine patriotism, I suppose. But I think at the core there is something more base than that. There's obviously a vested interest that very powerful investors and wealth owners and corporations have in trying to recreate a society in which business and capital, if you like, has the hammer, has the upper hand in every set of negotiations, not just between unions and employers, but every set of negotiations that goes on in society. So they have succeeded in Canada over the last quarter century in remaking the country as a more business-friendly, unequal place. We're still not as bad in those dimensions as the U.S. is, but they have profited from that strategy, and I think ultimately, that is what drives it.
And they support politicians who push that?
Certainly. Now, again, it's again a matter of degree. We do have better controls and regulations over the influence of money in politics. We've got relatively strict campaign funding rules in most parts of Canada. So you don't have the same kind of direct influence that the Koch brothers and others can play in your system. But money still equals power, even in Canada. And there's no doubt that the system has been manipulated by those who have money.
Dr. James Stanford, thanks so much for being with us today, sir.
It was a pleasure, Tom. Best of luck to you and your viewers in what you're trying to do to build a better place down there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And once again, his website's economicsforeveryone.ca, caw.ca, and progressive-economics.ca, Dr. James Stanford. And we'll be back tomorrow, of course. Could mandated prayers be coming to a public school classroom near you soon? Constitution aside, it could happen in Indiana. We'll have the latest. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.